We did yesterday, for those of you, thank you for coming back, those of you who've come back, and for those of you here for the first time, where were you yesterday? you better have a good excuse and get your, but no, it's really, it is, Padraig and I, as I said, have been doing these conversations throughout our islands over the last 3 or 4 months, and we're always extremely gratified when people turn up and with a willingness to engage. A willingness to engage with an ancient, ancient story, and on the one hand, and an extraordinarily pressing and at times distressing contemporary set of circumstances on the other. And bringing both of these together is something that gives us great joy and great pleasure and inspiration. And so it is. And we hope that what we do together is of value and delivers the same to those who turn up. So we're grateful that you're here. Yesterday, we did a kind of an extended reflection on Moab. And it would be really interesting. You might want to think about at some stage if this is hooked into you and it's still there, to take those first 5 verses of the book of Ruth and to think about the Moab in your life, to think about the Moab in your nation's life, and to take a step back and rewrite the first 5 verses of the book of Ruth in 2018 in the United States. What are the stereotypical attitudes or stories that we tell about the other in our circles? And how can we reframe those stories about the others in our lives in such a way that we put our readers or our hearers on the back foot? How do we tell counter-narratives to the ones that dominate our headlines and our news cycles and the Twitter sphere and all the rest of it? Because that's part of our task, I think, as people of faith. We live in an alternative story. We are the inheritors and the stewards of an alternative story to the story that the world lives by. And if we don't live it out and tell it out in a clear way, then is it any wonder that the world goes the way it does? And so we ended up yesterday with the possibility that the storytellers and the songwriters and the poets might be those who can save us in this day, that the stories we tell and the poems we tell and read and share and the songs we sing. But there's alongside the stories and the poetry and the music and those other forms of art, there's another one that's actually is in many ways unique to us, in some ways unique to us. And I hinted at it at the end of yesterday with the question I asked. And today I want to consider it in a little bit more detail, and that is liturgy. And how the liturgy of our faith communities can be a vehicle by which we can act out or embody that other story to the one that the story of the stereotypical story of the Moabs in our lives. So I want us to think about liturgy. I guess, given that this is a Lutheran retreat center and many of you are Lutheran, many of you have lived out a rhythm of liturgy for through all the seasons of your life. There may be some in the room for whom the liturgy your faith tradition doesn't have a very clear liturgy that you could point to in a book, but there is a liturgy there. But the practice and performance of faith, I want us to think about that today. And we're going to do a quick sort of thematic conversation about an issue in the book of Ruth. And then we're going to dive into the text and do some close reading of the text together. And don't worry, I know you are you are, as I said, it's a room of majority of you are Lutherans. So I'm going to put the Bible up on the screen because I assume you're not carrying them because you're not good Irish Presbyterians who carry our Bible with us everywhere. Actually, most of it's up here. We just kind of just thought I'd say it. So I'll have the text on the screen and hopefully it'll be an opportunity for us to read some text together and discuss it. The nature of these conversations we've been having is that no two of them are the same. We go with a broad idea of a headline and a couple of key kind of points, but the actual practice of the thing depends on the group. And so I've got a few ideas and I've got slides and things that we may follow and we may jettison at some stage into the time we have together, depending on where the conversation goes. But just for a moment, and I know some of you hate this and struggle with this, that's okay. If you don't do what Padraig, take Padraig's advice from last night's children's talk. And if you don't want to talk to the person beside you, just say, I'll keep it to myself. Okay? And the person beside you is not to be offended if the person chooses to be private. So here, just for a moment or two, is the task. Take a moment to reflect together on the role that liturgy or the practice of your faith has played in the course of your life. For instance, when did liturgy save you? When did some practice of your faith life lift you and send you out on air? When did something in the liturgical life of the church or the practice of church, when did it challenge you and humble you? Just something, and it doesn't have to be deeply profound, just a moment when liturgy acted in your life. Okay? Make like you understand what I'm asking you to do and take a couple of moments.
Quiet, good.
Let me hear if you're willing to share some of your stories with us for a moment or two. When did liturgy comfort you or challenge you? When did liturgy save you? Anybody want to join the conversation?
We talked about funeral liturgies as being very meaningful. When either there aren't words, when the liturgy gives you...
Yeah, at those crisis times in life when something deep or profound or serious and sad has happened, when you can't trust your own words, the liturgy steps in and gives those words, provides those words, and words that are tested over generations. Lovely. That's really important. That's so important.
I find that the music that goes along with the liturgy is what speaks to me.
Right.
Because I love music, and I like to be a part of it. And so for me, the music is what often speaks to me.
At Eucharist on Sunday evening, I didn't know any of the hymns that we sang together. But I watched around the group and the number of you that knew the words without the books. How many, and I guess, and I mean, we all have those kinds of songs that are part of us, I guess. You never actually consciously sat down to learn the words. But by the repetition of those things over decades, I'm just saying in our conversation, I was raised in a Catholic family, and a variety of circumstances meant that we didn't continue, which is a whole story unto itself. But notwithstanding the kind of updates to the liturgy in the 40 years since I was a regular at Mass, I still know the liturgy. I still know it. But I never learned it. It was just by the repetition and the music, and the music works the same way and works to bind us together as we say these words together. Yes, and I've got a voice up here too. Yes, Anne. Go.
Well, two things as a follow-up to that. Our daughter just married a young man who was Catholic. Since then, he's joined the Luther Church. But his family is very strong Catholic. And we've been to a number of their services, in their funeral services. It's wonderful. They actually share much of the liturgy that the Lutherans have. They use Marty Halkin just like we do.
Yes. They'd probably claim that they had it first, too. Are you right?
The music becomes an instant connection.
Yes.
The other role is that we have been worshipped in Norway for a number of times, and in foreign language, but the music, even though you're singing in a foreign language, doesn't make any difference. You know what you're singing.
We, again, during the Eucharist on Sunday, I think it was Sunday, mm-hmm. I was standing, I'm going to talk about Padraig again, but I was standing beside Padraig, and when it came to saying the Our Father, Padraig recited it in Irish, and I in English, and it didn't matter that the languages were different. We were joining our voices in prayer across.
Liturgy is home. No matter where you travel, you are there on Sunday morning and you're home again.
Yeah, yeah. It holds you. Yeah, lovely. And therefore, I wonder, you know, to think about liturgy as, how do we make liturgy hospitable for people who are strangers to what is comfortable to us? Maybe one more. I saw a hand go up over here. Yes, sir.
Lord, have mercy, it fits wherever I go. I have not found a place that does not.
Brilliant. 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 My daughter is 22. She'll be 23 next year. And she goes to one of these cool and trendy churches. If Nadia was here, Nadia would say it'll be Brad and Stacy as the pastors. And, you know, they'll have cool, you know, skinny jeans. And, you know, he'll have his cool goatee and... Apologies if you're Brad or Stacy in the room. That's not what we meant. And you know, and the band and all the rest of it. And she's constantly trying, inviting her mum and I to go. And they have discovered liturgy. And they have borrowed from various places, and they put together things. And we, you know, it's all printed out, and we say the prayers together, and it's. Says, okay. That sounds brilliant. We have to live our way into liturgy. It has to become, and so it takes time, and it does its work in and through time. I said yesterday, nobody really knows when the Book of Ruth was written. But we do know how it's used liturgically within Jewish tradition. There are five wee books in the Hebrew Scriptures. They call them the Megaloth, or the five scrolls. Esther and Ruth, Song of Songs, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes. They're the five. And there are five great feasts within Hebrew tradition. And each of those five books is particularly associated with a particular feast. And at that feast, this short book is read in its entirety alongside a passage from the Torah. And I think it's worth a moment or two reflecting on how Ruth is used, because it's associated with the Feast of Pentecost. And it is read alongside the giving of the law, the story of the giving of the law in Exodus 19 and 20. That's worth pondering for a moment, and we're actually going to do a little bit of quick work with it. And I wouldn't be writing my PhD on what we'll do next, but it's worth having a quick look to have a think about this, because a couple of things flow from this liturgical coupling, and these two stories. The first in Exodus 19, it's the story of Moses going up the mountain to get the law from God. So, many of you will know the story. You know, they're instructed to build a fence around the bottom of the mountain because when God descends onto the top of the mountain, if anybody touches the place that touches God, they'll be killed. And in killing them, you're to stone them because something happens in this transference that if you were actually to lay your hands on them to kill them, you would be defiled as well. So you have to stone them from a distance. Like, this is weird stuff. And there's earthquakes, and there's deep, dark cloud, and there's trumpet blasts, and there's, you know, the mountain itself quakes, and people stand at a distance because they're so terrified. And it appears in the text that a lot of them were invited up the mountain to go and meet God, but actually when they saw what was happening to the mountain, they step back, and kind of Moses was a bit slow, and he's left at the front, and he becomes the one who goes up the mountain to meet God, and he gets the law. It's an incredible cinematic scene. You know how that would be filmed with CGI, and it's big, and it's terrifying, and it's world-shaking, literally. And then you read Ruth. And Ruth is the story of famine and death and refugees and three widows who are deep in grief, one who is almost paralyzed in her grief. It's the story of how do you survive as a foreigner in a strange land? It's a story of great kindness. Kindness that is transformative of the life of this young woman, transformative of the man who extends kindness in one instance towards her. It's transformative of the whole community, and we'll look at this transformative power of kindness tomorrow. It's a story of kindness. What have these two stories got that the rabbis placed them side by side? Two things I think are worth perhaps suggesting. One is that in the midst of great world-shaking and world-making events like Sinai, reading the book of Ruth is a stark reminder to us that in the midst of everything that terrifies, that shakes the world, don't forget the stories of individual people. Don't be so consumed by what's going on in the shaking of the world that we lose sight of people, of human beings, of flesh and blood. It is possible to be so consumed and to have the blinkers on that just see the big thing, that outside our sight is the lives and the survival of ordinary people. And so the rabbis are very careful to make sure that you keep these two things held tightly together. Because there's no doubt about it. You know, as we look back home and we see the Brexit situation and we see the mess that our government is in, as we look at, we talked briefly yesterday about all the anniversaries that are coming that are back home that are raising the tensions around our conflict, but the possibilities of the reimposition of borders and the resumption of violence on the island and so on. You know, it is fascinating to observe. It is fascinating to observe. Even in the middle of the mess, there is a strange and dark fascination with these big, big issues of world politics, of nationhood and so on. And in amidst all the mess that's happening over here, there is a strange, dark fascination. It is It is, dare I say it, entertaining. But some group have got to keep in view the fact that people are suffering here as well. And in our case, it might be the threat that farmers on the border have about loss of income and how they're going to survive and keep their farm back home. Or it might be to do with at the border, Protestants living at the border who are frightened about the resumption of Republican violence, which will mean they have to leave the land. Your stories here are different. But in the midst of the big, we've got to make sure we keep our eyes on the fallout of the big story for individuals. And maybe something about the liturgical coupling of these texts reminds us never lose sight. It's that kind of annoying voice from the side that is perhaps the role church has to say, there are people here. There are people here. The second thing, perhaps even more radical than that, and we'll pick it up tomorrow, is the radical idea that maybe the proper lens through which to view the law in the scriptures is the lens of kindness. Maybe Exodus and Deuteronomy and Leviticus and Numbers need, maybe the interpretive key to those obscure texts in Leviticus is the book of Ruth. As I said, we'll explore that a little bit more tomorrow. Maybe kindness is the proper interpretive key for the law. So what happens when the law conflicts with kindness, or when the law results in unkindness? Which is precisely what happens in the back two chapters, the last two chapters of the story of Ruth. Let me pause there for a moment to see if how you react to that. Comments or questions. Applause is always welcome. Anything you want to say, anything you want to add to that?
Kindness as a lens for the law is extremely difficult, I think, for American Christians, because it is you interpret one thing. I'm thinking of gays and lesbians. They often feel as if the church is speaking a word of law to them that is very harsh and condemning, not accepting. And I've challenged people sometimes to say that you acknowledge that you were saved by grace, but you end with the law. That's the Apostle Paul's book to the Galatians. You know, why are you returning to the law when you're saved by grace? And for them it was circumcision, but you know, there are other issues that happen. And so this notion of kindness as a lens for the law is like foreign language.
Yeah. And I think we'll look at that, and how difficult that is, actually, how hard that is, how radical kindness is. It's not niceness, it's kindness. It's a key word in the scriptures. It's a key word in this book of Ruth, and we'll talk. But I think you're right. It is a human instinct. Padraig and I were involved in a summer school in theology with young adults earlier in July at Coromila. And on the theme of borders. And we explored through various means with speakers and so on, this tendency of human beings. You know, we talked about and some of us were talking about it this morning, outside here over coffee, this tendency of human beings to the gospel message, the Bible message is this: come out, come out from these rigid systems where people are exploited and commodified, and come out into the wilderness. And somehow something happens in that story in Exodus that actually they get out of this system of commodification and power and oppression, and they get out into the wilderness. And the first thing they do when they get out into the wilderness is start building a mini system. And then there's another call: come away from that, come away from that. And it, you know, you get into Jesus, and then Jesus says, no, come to me and have rest. You know, don't give in to this impulse to. It is that constant movement that we work with, that we try to, because let's face it, very difficult to organize a church if you don't have rules. Very difficult to run a congregation if you don't have rules. But how do those rules function? How does that law function? And how does it serve kindness? But we will explore it, exactly those kinds of issues, tomorrow.
Well, the desire for people to have a border wall and to follow and enforce the law about people coming into our country, and yet we have laws for accepting people who come seeking asylum, and to be kind to them, and instead we take their children away and all that. So, you know, if we just acted with kindness, a lot of this wouldn't even have to happen.
So. How many of you in this room are here as a result of immigration? Okay, point proven. Now listen to this. I was reading this.
So I married an Arabic man from Sudan, and I mean, it took 2 years, $2,000 paperwork that is tricky to read and understand. And so you can accuse people of trying to buck the system. The problem is the system is too difficult for so many people trying to get out of horrible places.
That is, so, you know, well, let me put Bible text on what you've just said. Because I wrote this down, it was yesterday. No, today. This is from the book of Exodus 23, verse 9. You shall not oppress a resident alien. You know the heart of an alien, for you were aliens in the land of Egypt. This verse connects memory and neighborly care. This memory works its way out in ethical action. You shall not oppress a resident alien. You know the heart of an alien, for you were an alien. The verse presumes empathy. It presumes empathy. So as I think into the early chapters of the book of Deuteronomy, and it says again and again, remember, don't forget, because it's that memory, it's that empathy, or it's that memory that you have of your circumstances that enables you then to act with kindness, or that empowers you to act, or drives you to act with neighborly kindness. And that, in large part, that is the function of liturgy, is to constantly remind us again and again. Don't forget. So we broke bread together on Sunday night and we received it. You know, again, you know, hands up any one of us in the room that earned the right to take that bread on Sunday. We got it as a gift. We received that as a gift. Walter Brueggemann says, speaking of the sacrament of the Eucharist, he says, imagine having a sacrament called thanks. Isn't that just beautiful? Imagine a sacrament called thanks. And the very act of breaking bread receiving the bread. And I what are the words of the Lutheran liturgy and the giving of the bread? Yeah. And this is the blood of Christ shed for you. It doesn't ask you for a payment. It doesn't ask us to tick the boxes of how we've behaved in the previous week. And meanwhile, back at home in my own Presbyterian church, as it was mentioned briefly, I think Nadia mentioned it briefly in her talk, we are making infants pay the price of the perceived sins of their parents. And so we're denying them the sacrament of baptism, of welcome in, of belonging. Liturgy, you know, and I come back up here again, it's home. Liturgy is, this is the primary way we nurture our memory and we keep our empathy alive. Remember, you know the heart of an alien, for you were an alien in Egypt. And this little book, this, you know, we do it such a disservice when we treat it like a gentle love story. This story undermines so much of what we presume to be true in the world and tells us, you know, you put these two things together and it says, you know what? The real meaning of the world is not the shaking mountain. The real meaning of the word is a widow who in her grief somehow, and understanding that grief, somehow finds it within her to risk something for it, another widow. It's a man who in his plenty finds it within himself to act kindly towards a woman in need and to feed her and her companion. And in this, these simple kindnesses is what makes the world turn. That takes enormous faith to believe, that these acts of kindness are what is real. And what preserves what is real about our world. Not the big shaking mountain. And our Jewish sisters and brothers do us a wonderful service in keeping these two things together. And saying, wrestle with that liturgically. Right, we're way off beam. But that's good. Right, I'm going to read some texts together. We're going to actually read both of these texts together. Here's the task, and we'll do this together. I'm going to put some of the text from the book of Exodus up on the screen, and we'll take a moment to read it, and let's think about the picture of God that emerges from this reading of the book in this chapter in Exodus. And let's ask ourselves, do we like the picture of God that emerges from this passage in the book of Exodus? Okay? What picture emerges from the text? And do we like the picture that emerges? Hopefully you'll be able to see that. If not, you can move, seat, come closer. I'll read it. And the Lord said to Moses, go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow. Have them wash their clothes and be ready by the third day, because on that day the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. Put limits for the people around the mountain and tell them, be careful that you do not approach the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain is to be put to death. They are to be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on them. No person or animal shall be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast may they approach the mountain. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and they washed their clothes. And then he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the third day, abstain from sexual relations. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. As the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. What picture of God emerges from the text? And there's no right answer to this, by the way. That's not what I'm looking for. I don't have an answer written down here that I'm hoping someone gets an A plus. Just from our reading of the text, if we're going to read both of these side by side.
Mighty.
Mighty. Great word. Let's get them up on the...
Controlling.
Controlling. Sorry, I didn't hear the other one.
Almost.
Holy.
Distant.
Awesome. Unapproach, distant.
Scary. Gorgeous.
Here, I can only write at a... unapproachable, scary. There was one over here.
Distant.
Awesome.
Distant, awesome.
Severe.
Oh, goodness, yeah. I missed one there. I have forgot. It's distant, scary, awesome. Severe, awesome. That was it. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Like, he talks back. God converses. After a fashion. Now, because, you know, God is shaking the mountain and Moses is terrified. But he does talk. He does talk.
Caring.
Caring. How do you see caring?
He warns them not to come.
Well... is that caring? You could be caring, yes. Or it could be threatening. But yes, you're right. You're right. Now, so not everything's bad here. But this is a complex picture of God, and it's a complex picture of their understanding of what's going on here. But you know your place. You know who's in control and who's calling the shots. I mean, and some of the things there I like. Some of the things are, I'm glad to be associated with this God. Some of them, I'm confused about. But they are, that's part of our story. Let's read, and listen, and I know to some extent I am sampling text, but it's the kind of thing it's something you can do yourself. Take these two texts and put them side by side, you know, and read them together. We're just modeling something. Here's some of the Ruth text. What picture of God emerges, and do we like this God? Slightly longer piece here. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you and your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. What do we discern about God from this page? Let's keep these two pictures up. God provides. Yeah. And actually, did you notice the way the section ended? They return home just as the barley harvest was beginning. Here is a little promise of there's the story. Because you remember the chapter, this is the end of chapter 1. The beginning, the opening of the chapter was with famine in Bethlehem, the house of bread. And here is the sign of the transformation of circumstances. The story, we're entering into the second act now of the story. And things are beginning to change. So God provides. Lovely. It's God who. And do you know what? Isn't it interesting? In the context of the great big mountain shaking events of Sinai, here is a God who is concerned to feed people.
And yet, God to Naomi was uncaring and cruel.
That is certainly Naomi's experience. That is certainly how she experiences what happens to her. One thing that gives me pause on that, and I think this is just part of what it is to be human and what our limitations are. She experienced rejection from God. And it colored everything. I mean, the grief here is, God forbid any of us should experience the kind of grief and loss she experienced, to the extent that she no longer owns her own name. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. What's unusual about that in the context of how the story is unfolding?
She left in famine and she came back in plenty for the people, but she came back empty.
Yeah. How empty is she?
She's very empty. She's lost a husband, two sons, a daughter-in-law who's gone back to her own country, and she comes back with nothing to eat.
Except it's standing behind her is the woman who said, I'm not leaving you. And you know, I guess in people's experience of grief and loss, sometimes what some of you are pastors, you know this far better than me, that it's not the time to tell people, but look what you have. Look at all the things. But you know what? In the story, we know we are patient with Naomi. We are sensitive to Naomi. And we continue to care for Naomi because we know there is more in her life than at the moment she can discern. And it's important for her to express this sense of God's uncaring hardness, God, the loss that I've experienced. But one day, perhaps, we hope through the kindness and care of those around her, which is how the story unfolds. Sorry to be giving you some spoilers. She learns that she recovers her name. She takes her name back. But it requires the people around her to bear with her in her grief. God, it required the people around her to permit that kind of language. God has sent me, has brought me back empty. I wonder as we read this story, and I feel a bit of a fraud as a man reading this story about women and the relationships between women and the grief and how women carry their grief. But I do wonder, what was it like to be Ruth standing beside her, to hear this exchange with her former friends in Bethlehem, to say, I have nothing. I have just left everything to stay with you. Did you not hear the promise I made to you? But Ruth says nothing. Extreme kindness of Ruth. The sensitivity, the empathy that Ruth had to let this grieving widow rest with her grief. But we, as the readers of the story, we are let in on this. Ruth is there and Ruth will stay. And the harvest is beginning. Now the next chapter opens with Naomi struck dumb to the extent that Ruth has to take the initiative even just to feed the family. Anything else about the picture of God that emerges from here that we need to hold in tension with the big world-shaking God?
As you were describing both sets of scripture, it occurred to me that these are two different pictures of righteousness.
Speak up, because you're under the lip there, so people will be here.
These are two different pictures of righteousness. There's the righteousness which relates to the majesty of God, that he has control of the universe and made it and all that kind of stuff. And then there's the righteousness of God that
Yeah. That's beautiful. Yeah.
In the first verse, doesn't it say that Boaz was a righteous man?
Yeah. Yeah. For those of you, in case you didn't hear, in this second story, the holy righteousness of God is mediated through the human beings around Naomi. Or we might say in language that's more familiar to our tradition, the righteousness, the holy majesty of God is incarnated in the silence of Ruth and the accompanying Ruth. Now think about that for a moment, that this stuff here, that one of our roles as people, as individuals, one of our roles as the church is the mediation of this, is the incarnation of this in the world. Not just in the language of world shaking and where God is going to condemn and God is going to sweep and God, you know, and people are going to be condemned to hell and people are going to, but in acts of kindness and accompanying those who are bereaved and in feeding people and simple, small acts of kindness. Yes, God is majestic and righteous and holy and awful and powerful and capable of shaking the mountains around us. That's a scary God. And it's a scary God, particularly in contexts where people who are vulnerable have been abused by people with power to shake the world. And God needs, in that sense, God, imagine that statement, God needs. God is incarnated through our acts, through our making our way in the world. And good liturgy practiced over time and even generations embeds that within us, reminds us constantly, we have not earned this. God wants to feed you. These simple acts, acted out in our liturgy, our baptisms, as we welcome in new people into our community. You are baptized in among us, maybe forgive me if your theology of baptism is different than what we practice back home, but this sacrament of hospitality, of welcoming people in amongst us, is meant to remind us again and again of that saving empathy.
Looking at these two excerpts from the Bible, in my mind I'm looking at it that this is a culture of many gods, multiple gods, and I think in Exodus, so powerful, God is saying, I'm everything. And here, you have Naomi saying, I acknowledge that God is everything.
Say more about that. Say more, say a little more about...
Now,
that's really interesting.
God is caring, he's controlling, he's all of these. But it's like, what are the people doing? And there's I can't recall what they call it, but there is a story in Judaism where the mountain actually lifts and is over the people. Uh-huh. The people are looking up to the mountain, not looking up the mountain, but up to the mountain, because it's over them. It could crush them. And God is saying, I'm everything. And here they're in a culture where there's multiple gods. And they even look to the golden calf eventually because they want, want something they can see and touch. You can't touch God. You can't see God. But here you have Naomi all the way through who is acknowledging that he brought me forth. He brought me back empty. He has done all this to me. She's acknowledging this.
Yeah. It's classic Jewish faith. There was a magnificent documentary, a magnificent play that was filmed by the BBC some years ago about the death camps, about the Auschwitz. And it was filmed entirely inside one of the buildings, filled with Jewish men. And again, in a way that is so characteristic of Jewish faith, it's an argument. And some of the men in the room believe God is dead. And others are trying to hold on to faith in the middle of it. And so you have various people making their arguments. And then at the end, they all turn to the rabbi. And the rabbi, and they say, Rabbi, what do you think about this? And the rabbi says, this is quoting from my memory, is not the text of the play, but this is how it ends. The rabbi says, yes, here in this camp, God is dead. And everybody's shocked. And they say, well, what do we do now? And you can probably guess what the rabbi says. Now we pray. Now we pray. And with all the suffering that Naomi has gone through and all the loss she has experienced, it's still the Lord who brings her back.
But I think the two of these combined also make the statement, first commandment, There is
one God.
God.
Yeah.
And she's acknowledging that there is one God.
Yeah. And the other, and I think this, I think, I mean, and they are the opening, they are the opening words of God to this people that have only recently come out of Egypt. These are the opening words. You know, there was a God in Egypt. He was a Pharaoh. He was the ruler of everything. And let me tell you, I am the Lord. I was the Lord back there too. And I'm the Lord because I am. But it's the capacity of Naomi still to hold faith even in the midst of this loss. And also the generosity of Ruth. Don't urge me to leave you or turn back. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Where you die, I will die. And may the Lord deal with me. Your God will be my God. Now, it is possible to read that text as, in a sense, in contemporary terms, as Ruth's conversion. It is also possible to read that text to say that this is not a conversion as we would recognize. This is not God or Ruth embracing Yahweh and becoming a convert to Judaism. This is a woman who is fundamentally, first and foremost, committed to Naomi in relationship. And she embraces God, this God, only because of her relationship with Naomi. It is her commitment to caring for Naomi that involves her also taking on this God. And that's the depth of this woman's incredible commitment to this broken woman, despite her own brokenness, that she will exchange everything she has to stay with this woman. And then at the beginning of chapter 2, Ruth says, I'm going out to the fields. She had no right to go to the fields. In fact, the regulation allowing people to harvest behind the harvesters don't apply to her. They apply to Naomi. Didn't apply to foreigners. It's also an extremely risky thing to do for a woman to follow behind the harvesters. Naomi is so broken. It doesn't appear she didn't even warn Ruth of the dangers of what she was about to do. She let this stranger to the customs go out alone. But Ruth takes it on. So we're wrestling with some deeply profound. There is real depth to this story that, if we simply treat it as a love story, maybe that's not true. Maybe it doesn't happen here, but it's been true back home, and certainly in the conversations we've been having, people have said, but surely this is just a love story. And it is. There's an element of that. It's an element of that. But there's profoundness, there's a profundity in this as well. The capacity of holding on to God even when it appears God has rejected you. When the experience is of genuine rejection. Yes?
When Jesus said on the cross, why have you forsaken me? I am the death of
Yeah. That's really interesting, because when you put together all the words of Jesus on the cross, such as we can, he says, why have you forsaken me? His last words are, into your hands I commit my spirit. Extraordinary. This Psalm, I should know my Bible better. Your way led through the waters, though your footprints were not seen. Yes, The other thing, the wee hanging we put on our wall, you know, why is there only one set of footprints? That's when I carried you. Yes, that's true. There are occasions when that's true. There are also times when you're called to step out into the water and there's no track. There's no track to follow. What you have is a memory of a story of a people in similar type circumstances who stepped into the water and found it opening in front of them. And maybe that'll happen. And maybe it won't. The challenge is, am I still prepared to step and walk when there are no footprints? Resting on the things that I know. Anything else from this text of... Yes, sir.
Yeah, both parties are in a committed relationship with each other because of their faithfulness to each other. So that's carrying them through this hard time for both parties.
Can I push back on that just a little?
Yep.
To what extent in this is Naomi carrying Ruth? To what extent is Naomi carrying Ruth? Sorry?
She tells her to go back to her people.
Yeah.
But when she realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her.
First she releases her.
Yeah.
Well, wouldn't it modestly speak to a very deep relationship that's not even talked about in the story?
It could.
And then the other thing, to me, to put this in contemporary parlance, Ruth is showing us a process of the formation of moral conscience.
Yes.
And personal relationship.
Yes.
That goes against Jewish law, that risks herself. And so she's made that commitment. And to me, there's a tendency to over spiritualize. But this is an existential situation she's in.
Yeah. And I think, yes, you've said in a couple of sentences what I've taken an hour and 10 minutes to say. That there is I think there is one of the functions of liturgy, it seems to me, is to embed faith within us and to form us by the practice of liturgy and by the repeated practice of liturgy. It embeds itself in us and it changes us so that when the time of crisis comes, we respond almost by instinct. I almost get the sense, you know, maybe I'm reading too much, but there's almost a sense in this that Ruth hasn't thought of an alternative. She hasn't considered leaving Naomi.
Can she even return to her family?
Sorry?
Can she even return to her family?
Well, I mentioned it briefly yesterday in the context of you know, you remember we talked about, you know, watch out for those women. Watch out for those Moabite women, because we all know what they're like. Here is Ruth defying the stereotype, the expected responses of Moabite women, and that is to be unfaithful. And Naomi states, you know, they have remained loyal even to their dead husbands. They are entitled to get their contract, their wedding contract money back and carry it home, bring it back to their father's house so that on the off chance that they might find another man, there will be money. But it seems that neither Orpah nor Ruth demand this money back. which severely limit their options once they do get back home. So there is a sense in which Ruth, it was a Hobson's choice for Ruth in some ways, but I kind of think that the nature of the, I mean, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, is an oath, is a particular form of an oath that is unbreakable. And Naomi, that's in part why Naomi just shuts up at that stage. There's no point in reasoning with this woman. She has taken this death oath to stay with me, so we'll stay. But there is a, for me, there is something in Coromila, we have these resources that we use with groups, particularly I've used them with young people and young adults. And one is a set of stories called Bystanding, and the other is a set of stories called Upstanding. And the Bystanding stories are people or adults talking about circumstances in their lives when they were faced with a moral crisis or an ethical dilemma. And instead of doing what they thought was the right thing, they didn't. They were bystanders. And reflecting on that over time, the other is a story of where people faced with similar types of challenges were upstanders. And partly what we talk about and the questions we ask in relation to those resources, what is there within our faith tradition that equips us for doing the right thing when the moment calls for it? And liturgy has a role in that, to come back right again to this notion of empathy. You were an alien. So don't forget, you know the heart of an alien. Liturgy helps remind us of our giftedness, so that when the moment of challenge arises, we respond with we respond almost by instinct, because we've been shaped and formed by liturgy. Yes, sir?
I'm just thinking, it is quite possible that in the story that Naomi was different than some of the women at that time, because when somebody marries, sometimes the daughter-in-laws ended up as partial servant and serving the family. I have the idea that Naomi treated her sister-in-laws rather well. It also losing a husband, sons and everything is devastating in this day. It was much more devastating in that day.
Oh, yeah.
Because it was your only way of survival. You had sons, you had people who could take care of you. There was no social security. You had nothing without being continuing as a wife or your son's mother or something like this to provide for you. So this was a desperation.
It absolutely is, and we'll look at some of the risk involved in surviving as a woman, surviving as a widow, surviving as a refugee widow woman.
Especially in those days.
We need to begin wrapping up here. There are two. Can you make points quickly so that we can? Because I think we need to wrap up. Yes.
So, also the faithfulness of God in both giving the Ten Commandments and organizing wilderness that those people found themselves in, and in the faithfulness of God in giving Ruth the mail.
Yeah. Yes. The fact of the formation of this as a people is a mercy of God when they were slaves. Yeah.
I just want to say that as a woman, it's so important to me that this story is in our canon and in our scripture, and the significance of the story. I still feel, as a woman particularly, unfortunately, in the church, that, you know, in token only many times. And So I appreciate it, and you're making this link to liturgy, and so for me, in a sense, Ruth's silent in this section so far after her vows, her silent accompaniment of Naomi, as you pointed out, that beautiful word comes, and that Ruth can be the faith, she can hold the faith for Naomi when Naomi dies.
Yeah, that is
what a true friend and a true accompaniment does, and that's what liturgy can do for us too. When those words are meaningless, we can still go and take the gift.
Yes, and we did that when the gentleman who mentioned the funeral liturgy. It gives us words when we don't have them, and when we need them and we don't have them. Just some kind of hidden things. I said that the word kindness is a big word in the Hebrew scriptures. The word chesed, the loving kindness of God, which is used here. May the Lord show you chesed, as you have shown chesed. There's a remarkable thing here. This is a word that by and large is reserved for God. And here it has been attached to these two women. They have shown godlikeness in their actions towards. And I mean, we don't have time to look, but It reoccurs again in this section in chapter 2. Look at another thing worth pointing out. Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. Now, if you were to just close your eyes and open your ears and forget that we're reading the book of Ruth, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before." Who's that? I hear the whispers. Where does that... That's an echo. That's an echo of a story. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. Where's the first call? Abraham. Abraham. And Abraham. And here, this woman is being commended for acting in the same way that the father of faith acted. Every bit the person of God that Father Abraham was, this refugee woman is. Now tell me that isn't an extraordinary thing. They are the writer of the story applies to her the same terms that are usually reserved for God, and this refugee, this foreigner, is being described in terms of the patriarch. Every bit the person of faith that Abraham was. It's quite extraordinary. And enlargement, this is where I want us to finish. In large part, right throughout this story, it is the capacity of the people of the village and of Boaz to notice this in Ruth. They are not, to come back to our conversation yesterday, they are not constrained in their treatment of Ruth by the stereotypes they have of Moabite women. They permit this Moabite woman to break the stereotype. They pay attention to how she acts. I don't know if it made the news over here, but there's an extraordinary story a month or two ago from Paris of a Malian refugee who scaled the front of the building to rescue the baby. Yeah, you got this story? It's an amazing story. He was in Paris waiting on his papers being processed, unsure about whether he was going to be admitted. And the mayor of the city And the president of the country said, why would we not allow a person like him into the country? He wasn't constrained by the stereotypes of African immigrants into Paris. But he was permitted by his actions. He was permitted by his actions to break the stereotype. And when people were prepared to pay attention to that, the law is changed. And that's what we're going to pick up tomorrow. But I want to leave with this notion of the importance of attention. How liturgy can alert us and make us sensitive and keep us empathetic, can enable us to pay attention to those that are breaking the stereotypes of what the big world makers are saying. And I want to end as, you know, one of the things we're trying to say here is that artists have a role amongst us. Liturgists have a role amongst us. I want to end with a small poem. Some of you will know this poem. It's a poem by Mary Oliver. And I'll read it, and then we'll have a moment of silence. And then we're done. It's a poem about paying attention. She actually, probably the shortest poem she's written, has got three lines. Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. How about that for a pattern of living? Pay attention, be astonished, tell about it. But this is not the poem I'm going to give you. This is another one where she pays attention. And out of paying attention, she issues a challenge to us. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Pay attention. Paying attention and noticing is one way in which we will subvert the dominant narratives that claim they can shake the world. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for staying, and hopefully see some of you tomorrow.